Right, let's get started. Welcome everybody to the latest in our Employment Law 101 bite-sized webinar series. For those of you that haven't joined us before and don't know us, my name is Peter. I'm a partner here with MPM Legal. We're a specialist employment law and business immigration practice. We're based in the south of England. We work with clients all over the UK and in fact all over the world, and they've got a common interest, which is employing people who work here in the UK. Joined today by my colleague Adrienne. Morning, Adrienne.
Morning.
And we are talking to you today about immigration in the recruitment phase of the employment law cycle. This session is being recorded, so we are going to host it on our website in the coming days. So, feel free to go back and replay anything that you find useful. As with all of our webinar sessions, we're absolutely open to questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please use the Q&A function that's down at the bottom of the screen rather than the chat function. By all means, type something in the chat function, say hello, tell us where you're joining from today. But if you've got specific questions, use the Q&A function because that just helps us manage them a little bit more easily behind the scenes. So, in terms of this session, like I said, we're carrying on with our theme of recruitment today, and we're chatting about some of those pre-employment immigration checks that you need to be carrying out when you're looking to expand and bring people into your business. First of all, you've got to think about the right to work checks that you must carry out. And the key point here is that these checks have to be done before the individual starts with you. So that means it's not good enough if somebody shows up on day one of employment, bringing their passport or whatever other documents you're looking at verifying on that first day, because that is not compliant. And I do encounter that scenario quite a lot. You don't want to be in a situation where somebody rocks up, you have a look at their documents, and actually it turns out, for whatever reason, they don't have the right to work in the UK, or they're not able to establish that when you're meeting them. Because on that day one, they are already your employee. You are already employing them, and you might be employing them unlawfully, which could give you a problem. Now, hopefully, many of you will not fall, or all of you will not fall into that category, and you'll be doing those sorts of checks as part of your recruitment process already. And if it's done there, and if you encounter any issues, you've got time before the employment relationship starts to actually iron out those problems as well. So you can make a decision then about, are you going to proceed with the hire or not? Watching out for any discrimination issues, of course, which I'll talk a little bit about in a moment. So in terms of this process, what does it actually look like? Well, you can break it down into three steps. Obtain, check, and copy is the easiest way to remember it. So first of all, you're obtaining the right documents from the candidate. Now, when it comes to what documents you're able to use, helpfully, UKVI, which is UK Visas and Immigration, so they're the governmental body that's responsible for immigration, employment-related matters, they have a really handy list of all of the documents which are acceptable for you to be able to rely on to establish that you've done your checks properly. That list does change from time to time. I always revert back to it when I haven't been looking at it for a while, just to check that nothing has been removed or added to it that might be useful. But that should be your starting point. The UKVI list of documents has a list. So you want to obtain the necessary documents from that list. Now, those documents, may differ from occasion to occasion, but you can walk through the list. It does set out some quite clear examples within it. So that's the first step, obtain. Second step is to check the documents. So you want to do that in the presence of the candidate as well, ideally, because what you're looking for there is to check that those documents are original documents, they've not been altered, they're not obvious, forgeries or fakes in any way. And then you want to take a copy of those documents. And the reason you're taking a copy of the documents is that you want to be able to record the fact that you've done these checks. And you want to be able to establish, if you're asked later by the authorities, what documents you actually had sight of, so you don't get into trouble. Now, those copies that you take, they can be manual hard copies. So you can take a photocopy of something, or you may take an electronic copy as well, as long as the electronic copy cannot be manually altered. So PDF would be acceptable. Now, I know there's PDF editing software out there, but it's probably going to be traceable if you've edited a PDF. Not that you want to go into, you know, doing that at all. But if you take an electronic PDF copy of a document, then that is something which is acceptable. If you stick to those principles, obtain, check, and copy, that's your starting point pre-employment. Now, in terms of...
Can I just jump in there? Sure. I was just going to say, when it comes to taking the copy, it's also just a really good idea in terms of your record keeping that you take the copy, the person who takes the copy signs and in particular puts a date on it, so that if you do get audited by the Home Office and they come knocking on your door showing us the right to work checks, then you can point to it and say, yeah, look, this is the date on which it was taken. This is the date on which their employment started. And, you know, you're putting a big tick in the box of, well, great, you've got the right process in place. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, no. So that's a really good point. It's a really good point to validate those copies. Now, the other big watch out when you're doing these checks is you want to avoid discrimination, because basically individuals have the ability to be able to bring discrimination claims, even if they've not actually started employment with you, because protection under the Equality Act starts during the recruitment phase. So you're not permitted to discriminate against people pre-employment, basically, which is logical and understandable. Now, the watch out here in terms of where discrimination dovetails with all of this is, if you take the approach of just doing immigration checks on people that you perceive to be not British, then that's obviously discriminatory. And what you should be doing is applying uniform self-checks to every new hire that you get, whether they're obviously British or not. So just bear that in mind. Now, if you're looking for any more pointers over exactly how that process works, the Home Office actually have a code of practice, and it's called something like avoiding discrimination in the recruitment process, you know, snappily titled, but it's all laid out for you there. So the resources are free and are available. So the two key ones from this section are the UKVI list of documents, so you know exactly what it is you're allowed to rely on. And secondly, this Home Office code of practice. It's been around for about 6 or 7 years now, but that's really useful if you're looking to build into your general recruitment strategy some checks and balances on not inadvertently opening yourself up to discrimination claims. And there have been some pretty high profile ones as well. So that's all kind of well and good when we're in normal, regular times. But obviously, we've all been working in a bit of a weird way over the past 18 months because of COVID. And we've all been working like this, you know, on Zoom calls from the comfort of our kitchens and bedrooms and so on. So, Adrienne, what are your thoughts about kind of the impact of COVID on this and how, you know, systems and processes might have been flexed slightly?
Well, I mean, we had lots of queries. Obviously, during the pandemic, when everybody was locked down, which was quite nice to talk about recruitment rather than redundancy, I have to say. But obviously, people were in a bit of a flat spin panic about how they could take people on, satisfy the right to work checks when nobody was working in the office. So the government, as I'm sure all of you know, just brought in the online checking process, you know, it could all be done remotely, pretty much as we are now, to make sure that you could still comply. And you just note down on the copies of the documents that it was verified remotely in line with the COVID guidance. And that was, you know, that was a really sensible way of proceeding. What was then not quite so sensible is when the government went, hey, we're opening up the country, right, we're going to bring an end to that online process. And I had a number of my clients go, well, we're not opening our offices. What do we have to do? Do we have to get somebody to sit in reception and, you know, invite people in to show their passports? But luckily, after a bit of lobbying, the government went, yeah, that's a bit daft, isn't it? We recognise that not everyone's opening up. So that online process, if you are not fully opened, is actually still in place until April next year. So you can make use of that process. And I think it's really important to make sure that you do still use that process to comply, because you're not going to avoid the illegal working penalties if you say, well, we couldn't do the checks in time because of COVID and because we were all working remotely. So, you know, there is that process in place to help you.
Yeah. Okay. And in fact, we've had a related question to that about, so thank you for this question. Our offices are closed because of COVID. Can we accept that the candidate shares on screen or sends us copies of information?
Exactly that. Yeah, exactly that. So you might want to get them to send you the the electronic PDF so that you've got that copy officially. And then you would arrange a Zoom call where they would hold their passport or their document up to their face so you could check it, you could see it clearly. Some people are even taking screenshots of the picture of the person on the screen with the passport held next to them, all that type of good stuff. Like, yeah, exactly. Yeah, we should have done that, shouldn't we?
I know, I could have come with my passport.
You could have come with your passport, yeah.
Blurred out all of the sensitive information.
Yeah, here's one we prepared earlier. Yeah, but yeah, so that's exactly the way to do it. And then in the same way, you would still make a note on the copy that you've taken or that's been sent to you by PDF, noting the date on which you took it, etc. All of that good stuff to demonstrate that you've complied with it.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I mean, I was just thinking that some people joining today might be thinking, well, so what about this? You know, what actually are the real world consequences if we get this stuff wrong or if we just ignore it? And hopefully none of you are going to fall into the bracket of blissful ignorance and just ignore these obligations. But
you did say
none
of you, didn't you? I did say none of you, not one of you. Yeah.
in real terms, you know, what are the kind of risks associated with all this? What are the consequences?
Yeah, well, that's the consequences are pretty severe, as I'm sure you've probably read in the press when it's been started. And it's this sort of came into sharp focus for me with when we're doing our immigration practice, because not only can you face civil penalties, and I think it's up to £20,000 per illegal worker, you can also face criminal convictions if it's really serious. You know, if you have properly driven a coach and horses through the right to work check procedure and you just haven't bothered at all, and you are knowingly employing illegal workers, then it carries a prison sentence of up to 5 years and an unlimited fine. They can close your business down. They can disqualify the directors of the business, all kinds of things like that. So pretty serious and wide ranging powers. But from the immigration perspective that I tend to look at is if your company has a sponsor license, for example, and you are sponsoring migrant workers, they can revoke that license. And that means that you won't be able to reapply for a license for a while. And you will also have to send home any sponsored migrants because they will no longer have the right to be here either. So the penalties are pretty wide ranging. So it is important to make sure that you are doing those checks properly. I mean, look, if it's the odd one that you've missed, then, you know, go ahead, make the check now, etc. Just straighten up your records. It's unlikely that those types of severe penalties would be issued to you if it's a genuine mistake. So it is just a question of being smart and being on the ball on this. But, you know, it's not something that should just be ignored.
No, totally. And I think actually one point that might be useful for people to think about, you know, perhaps into 2022, given the state of flux we've had over the last 18 months, given the changes around the EU situation and Brexit, is now the right time to be doing some kind of in-house audit on the systems that you've got in place, the processes you've got in place, and the records that you've got as well. Because that's something that might be really, really beneficial for you to do, just so you get that peace of mind that actually what you've got set up does work, and going forward, you've got that right strategy in place.
I think you mentioning sort of like the Brexit thing is really critical, because obviously one of the issues that people are facing now is, whereas, you know, EU citizens could just come and go as they please and come and work here without any, you know, any visa issues, etc. That's not the case anymore. So, Peter, what do we do about EU workers in terms of the right to work checks? Do you want to just run through that quickly?
Yeah, because that's all changed, of course, because of the Brexit situation. So, you know, prior to Brexit, but it's not quite as straightforward as that. Prior to the rules changing as a result of Brexit, what you were able to do when it came to EU workers was simply check their passports to check that they were EU national, because we had freedom of movement and we could all go and work in any of the EU member states. Obviously, that no longer works. So now when you are looking at new candidates, you do need to ask for their employer for a share code. And that means you can access this online checking system, which has been put in place. Now, if the individual has settled or pre-settled status, the system will say that they have the right to work in the UK. So as a reminder, the settled and the pre-settled status, that was all about EU workers that were already working in the UK. They were in the UK originally prior to the 31st of December 2020, I think. Correct me if I'm wrong, Adrian. But they're in the UK by that deadline, and they put their application in. And if they've got settled status, broadly speaking, they've been here for 5 years and then have the right to continue to live and work here. If they had pre-settled status, it meant that they were here before that December deadline, but they didn't have the 5 years of living and working here, or weren't able to show that, but they're allowed to live and work here in the meantime while they accrue that to get to that 5 years, and then they can put an application in for settled status. Now, there's this online checking system that you can utilise to see if an EU worker has either of those statuses, and if so, then you're able to rely on the information there. If, however, the individual tells you that they've made an application and they haven't had a response to an immigration type application or through that system, then they should have some kind of document that they can show to you to verify that they've made an application. And what that then gives you the ability to do is use the employer verification service to make your checks. So again, there's another government service, the employer verification service, which can be utilized as well. So you go to this independent, I say independent, it's independent of the worker. You go to the independent service and you verify that information that way.
Mm. Yeah, they're two separate services.
Two separate things.
Yeah.
But it's a bit more complicated when it comes to EU workers, isn't it, Adrian?
Yeah, well, it's a bit more complicated about, you know, we get asked all the time, what do we do about current EU employees, you know, that have been working with us for a while? Do we need to carry out any checks? And technically, no, you don't, because the guidance basically says that if you've done the checks properly when they joined you, so way back when, you've done the obtain check copy process, and you have a copy of their EU passport on your file, then actually you don't need to do anything further. But of course, it isn't ever that simple, is it, Peter?
No, absolutely not. I think basically, if you've done those checks properly, you don't need to do anything. You don't need to do anything else. If you've got somebody, I mean, I think the issue around you employing an EU worker that you might have employed for a long time, who then hasn't applied for settled status or the like, and has then left the UK, maybe to go on holiday somewhere, is a risk that they're not actually able to get back in to the UK. So, you know, that's why it's significant, I think.
And also they might not be able to access various services as well. So, for example, you know, if they want to rent a flat or they want to access the NHS, then very often those checks can be made at that point as well. So that's why it's important for these guys to have, well, hopefully have already done it.
Yeah, and we've certainly had a couple of queries this year where the employers become aware of an existing employee who hasn't actually made that application for settled status or pre-settled status. So whereas previously they were able to rely on, you know, right to work checks that might have been done at the start of the employment relationship, the employer subsequently become aware that the individual hasn't made one of the applications which they were supposed to make. Now, the situation gets a little bit complicated in terms of what you need to do as an employer if you're faced with that. But broadly, I mean, of course, I will always say take specific legal advice on the individual circumstances that you're facing at the time. That's really important. But broadly, there is a mechanism where there's like a 28-day period for the individual to be able to put in a late application for settled or pre-settled status and be able to explain and have the opportunity to explain why it wasn't reasonable for them to make an application earlier, as they ought to have done. Then they're kind of in the system then, and then there's a series of steps that you can take as the employer to avoid any penalty. However, if it then transpires that after that 28-day period, the individual's still not submitted an application for settled or pre-settled status, you're into the realms then of looking at actually terminating on the basis that to continue employment would be a breach of the rules and you'd be employing someone who wasn't able to establish the right to work in the UK lawfully. Now, that's quite a serious consequence, especially if you've got, you know, a background working relationship with that individual. It may end up being a discriminatory dismissal, and it may be an unfair dismissal if you get it wrong. So again, to reiterate, if you find yourself in that situation where you've got a reasonable belief that some of your EU workforce haven't made those applications and you want to know what to do, please do take some legal advice before you take any drastic action, really, just to know where you stand.
I think that just leaves the sort of the final category on the right to work checks, which is anybody who is, you know, not a British citizen and is not an EU worker who's already in the UK. So if you're checking somebody from outside of the UK, and there's and that obviously includes any EU workers that you want to recruit who haven't already been here or weren't here before the 31st of December. And the two key points on that are, check the list of documents that Peter's talked about in terms of what you can accept. But you're looking for a visa, it might be a biometric residence permit, it might be another document, it might even be a certificate of application if they've made an application that is pending, in which case you go to the employer's verification service. So that's the key point. That's what you're looking for. You're looking for that document. And the second key point is that it's most likely that whatever happens with their permission, it is going to be time limited. So unlike your British citizens with the passports and your EU workers with their passports, it's not a case of once you've done the check, that's it, you're off the hook. So what, you know, in terms of what your process would look like, you would carry out that check. You'd make sure that you entered into your HR calendar the, you know, a reminder that you need to check before their current permission expires, and then you run the check again. And essentially, you might have somebody who's here on a, you'll know if you're sponsoring somebody, but you might be sponsoring, you might be employing a points-based system dependent worker who isn't being sponsored by you. So you put the date in of when their visa will expire, and then they'll go for an extension. You'll put that date in for when that expires. And that way you're repeating your checks in time. And that's part and parcel of the records that you're required to keep. I'm just going to jump in here and ask a really good question, actually, which is whether or not you have to self-report, whether you have to fess up. And certainly sort of we've seen in parallel, for example, with national minimum wage transgressions, it's always a lot better to go cap in hand to HMRC and fess up because they look on you more kindly. I think in this situation, it really just does depend on what you've done. I think the key thing to remember is that the failure to have the process in place is not of itself wrong. Okay, so that's not going to expose you to the penalties. It's only if you are employing somebody illegally. Right. So if your process has fallen over and you find out you're employing somebody illegally, then that's the time to ask the question of whether you should self-report. And it's a tricky one. And this is where I become the lawyer with two hands, where I go, on the one hand, you might want to go to them cap in hand if it's, you know, if there are many that you've missed, and say, we're really sorry, we haven't done it. You are going to probably end up with a financial penalty, but it will probably be mitigated down because you fessed up. On the other hand, if it's the odd person, you might think, actually, do you know what? I'm really pleased we found it. We're going to put our system straight. And then it's a question of keeping your fingers and toes crossed that it doesn't get picked up on an audit. That, to be honest, is kind of my one hand and two handed answer to that question.
Yeah, I'm thinking I might be wrong on this, but I think we have encountered situations in the past where, certainly when it comes to clients and their sponsor management obligations, so we're talking about clients that hold a sponsor license to sponsor migrant workers, have encountered the odd kind of wriggle where things have fallen through the gaps. Am I right in thinking that, you know, that those situations have kind of been resolved quite well, actually, in terms of, you know, significant penalties, or I think the authorities have been quite open to an employer going and saying, "Oh, we've just picked up
proactive approach."
Proactive. Okay. By the way, if you can hear any tapping in the background, I haven't got somebody locked in that cupboard trying to get out. It's just I think there's just some building work going on nearby, so just ignore the knocking sound. In terms of the other checks that we might look at then, when it comes to starting the employment, so moving away from the actual immigration checks, there are a few other things that we wanted to get in and mention, because these might also factor into your recruitment process. And I think you wanted to say something about DBS checks, Adrian.
Yeah, a lot of employers want to do DBS checks as standard, and that's always a really tricky one. I won't spend too much time on it because it is really specific. The only thing that I would say is if you're recruiting for specific roles that require DBS checks, so working with children, vulnerable adults, certain financial roles, then yeah, great, go for a DBS check. And then if anything adverse comes up, then you've got the opportunity not to recruit. But the basic rule is if it's none of those roles, you can decide not to recruit. But, you know, if you're employing somebody who you then discover has an adverse DBS record, then you've still got to follow a process when it comes to dismissing somebody because it's not automatic. So that area is particularly tricky. So don't think you can just do a DBS check and as of right, that's it.
Yeah,
that's all I'm going to say on that because it is so specific. So should we just cover off a couple of other bits and bobs?
I wanted to say something on health checks because that comes up quite a bit. Again, unless the role actually requires a specific health check, then you're quite limited in what you can do. And the guidance here is really to leave any questions you want to ask a candidate about health really until you've made the job offer, because then you're asking for the right reasons. And primarily, you know, those reasons could be to establish whether someone's got a disability within the meaning of the Equality Act, and therefore whether you as an employer need to make any reasonable adjustments to accommodate that disability. Now, a kind of a watch out, learned experience on this from, you know, very many tribunal claims that we've seen over the years is do act on the information that you get, because I can't tell you the number of times where it comes out at a claim phase and individuals saying, well, my employer knew that I was disabled because I filled out this questionnaire and handed it to my manager on day one. And the manager doesn't do anything with it, or it just gets filed away and no one looks at it. And then 5-6 years down the line, when the individual's bringing a disability, Disability Discrimination Act claim, when they're bringing a disability claim, for example, there's an argument over whether the employer had knowledge or ought to have knowledge over whether the person was disabled or not, out comes this document in disclosure. And it's quite hard for the employer to then say, we weren't aware this individual was disabled, because they've ticked the box to say that they are, and they've written some details about their disability on the form. So if you are getting that information, do make sure that it isn't just lost and you actually have the next step covered, which is what do we do in light of it? The last thing that I wanted to mention is about references. So obviously at the recruitment phase, what we've seen over the years is references just getting really, really bland. They tend now just to be dates of employment, confirmation of job title, maybe something vanilla in terms of what the job duties actually entailed. But very rarely do I see references which are actually commenting either way on somebody's performance or abilities, for example. So there isn't an awful lot to say on this, other than if you're taking up references, if you're thinking of taking up references, then probably do take them up, because at least you get the information about start finish dates as well. I know it's not really directly relevant at the recruitment part, which is what this talk is about today, but flipping it to the end of the relationship, if you're in a position where you're giving a reference, then you've got to be careful not to misrepresent what you're saying. I mean, it's also relevant if you get an absolutely glowing reference in respect of someone who turns out to be absolutely rubbish, and it's just obvious that their capabilities don't match the reference you've got at all on that person, because there is a potential civil claim of negligent misrepresentation. There have been cases on it where a company has sued the former employer and said, well, we've relied on the content of this glowing reference to employ this person, and it turns out this person is absolutely rubbish. So we're going to sue you for making that misrepresentation on it. We've had a question actually on references. What about a request for FCA regulated references? Are the questions on this quite extensive? Yeah, I think they are in a regulated environment, and it applies probably not just to FCA regulation, but in terms of maybe in the teaching profession, for example, maybe in the medical profession as well. There are certain regulated industries where the obligations to provide information might be more onerous. But if you're working in that environment, then you're probably going to have access to the resources that tell you exactly what you should and shouldn't be saying in response to those types of questions. Is there anything else that you wanted to add on that, Adrienne? I'm not asking that for a particular reason, but...
Well, no, I was just going to add on the FCA point as well, is that coming back to your point about what reference you actually give, the person asking the question is absolutely right. You can't just give a bland reference on that. You are required to provide certain sort of good character-based information. So in that situation, you would provide more detail.
Yeah, excellent. So that's it for our bite-sized session today. As I said, a recording of this is going to be available. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. There is going to be another session. I think it's in 2 weeks' time. I apologize if I got that wrong. I think 2 weeks today will be the next session. As always, if you've got any colleagues, anybody else you think would be interested in joining these sessions, please direct them to our website or to our LinkedIn page, and you can sign up through our website link as well. Otherwise, thank you for joining today. Thank you for your questions. Enjoy the rest of your week, and we will see you next time.
Thanks, everyone.